This is Arthur Gomes. Gomes? Yes. Veal One. And first of all, Arthur, if I could ask you about life in Hong Kong before the war, how long had your family lived in Hong Kong?
Well, I was born in Hong Kong, and my family had been in Hong Kong up to the time of the war. And of course, they were here during the period of occupation, that is from 1941 to 1945.
Yes, I was wondering about your parents, your mother and father.
Yes.
When did they come? Were they born in Hong Kong?
My mother was born here in Hong Kong. Her name, Maria Augusta Gutierrez Gomes. And my father, he was born in Macau. His name, Elias, which we pronounce Elias, just Francisco Gomez. He was a civil servant working in the General Post Office in Hong Kong. And he met my mother because my grandfather was also working in the General Post Office in Hong Kong and was in a senior position to him, being, of course, an older man.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
I do. I have one full. My mother married after my father passed away. My father passed away when I was quite young, and after some years she remarried. But she married another man with the same surname. So her name never changed. I have one sister, my elder sister, Elsa, who was 4 years my senior. She passed away in England many years ago. And Mum, after the war, the whole family went to England after the war. Mum, my full brother, my full sister, and my two half-sisters, Edith Gomez, which is now Edith Oliver, and she's living in Pellington with her family, and a younger sister, Maria, she married a Scotsman, the first one was married to an Irishman, and my younger sister was married to a Scotsman with the surname Arthur, which caused a lot of confusion when they were looking for Mrs. Arthur. They always thought that she was my wife, but with the local people here.
Tell me about your education, Arthur. Where did you go to school?
I went to school right here in Hong Kong, in St. Joseph's College. In those days, St. Joseph's College had a branch school in Kowloon that taught from what was then class 8 to class 5. Education in those days were just 8 classes, from 8 to 1. Class 2 was called junior, and class 1 was matriculation. At the junior level was Cambridge, and it was university entrance. And matriculation was generally regarded as second year of university, and we were admitted into university as such. The branch school in Kowloon had only from classes 8 to 5. And when I reached that level, I'd go to Hong Kong side. It was also St. Joseph's College in Kennedy Road, which is not far from here. And from there, they were very democratic. They were building the new school called La Salle College, and it was in the middle of Kowloon Tong. In those days, it was in the middle of nowhere, like Sahara, partly wrote there. So the Christian brothers who ran the school decided that all those who lived in Kowloon should go to the school, to the LaSalle College in Kowloon. So they said, all those who lived in Kowloon put their hands, so we put our hands, and off we went. We were assigned to go to Kowloon. Of course, traffic was a problem, so we all bought push bikes and rode to school. Well, we were very happy because our parents had to buy a bike.
So how old were you when you left school then, Arthur?
Pardon?
How old were you when you left school?
Well, I was 17, about 17.
And what did you go straight into work? Did you go to work?
I went to help a friend in a motor garage, Mountain Alphonston, is a Scotsman, and he was staying with a friend next door to me in Kowloon Docks. My stepfather was an employee of the Hong Kong and Whampoa Dockyard, which is now the Whampoa Gardens. And in the shipyard, mostly were Scotsmen. So we had a little community of our own, the Kowloon Dock kids. And many of the dock kids, were lost their lives in the Battle of Hong Kong. I was struck with what I was saying.
What was it like? I mean, when you look at Hong Kong today with all the skyscrapers, was it very different before the war, Hong Kong?
Yes, a great difference. Up to the time of the war, as far as I can remember, buildings in Hong Kong were not allowed to go more than 7 or 8 stories high. And, of course, up at the peak, if you want to build more than 2 floors, you have to have special permission, and it was not always granted. It is interesting to note that I read in the papers a few days ago that there will be height restrictions on buildings up at the peak. Well, the height restriction is 22 floors. So there's quite a difference, and I certainly feel that difference from my school days and today. Kindergarten was almost for free, and most of the time I was in school, the school fees were $3 to $5 a month. Today, kindergarten classes for children are paying over $100,000 a year, and plus $12,000 a year for lunch allowance. So even it was not far from what people are paying for tertiary education. So what's the difference?
Of course, Hong Kong would have then been under the British, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Yes. But was there much in the way of class distinction before the war with the British? What sort of social life was it?
I don't think it has changed much. The British were very liberal, and we are also free in Hong Kong today. I think it was a gradual improvement all along, and that gradual improvement has not ceased. It kept on going, and we could realize our dreams in Hong Kong all along. So there, I wouldn't say that there was any moral or social restrictions.
How about the connections with the mainland China in those days? because China was very much in a war situation, wasn't it, in the 1930s. Was there much sort of worry about what was going on in China?
I don't think that people in Hong Kong were very politically minded. They came to Hong Kong for stability and for the purpose of doing business. The people of Hong Kong are all dollar-minded, and all dollar-minded people come to Hong Kong. and they have, I don't think, any particular political affiliation at that time. Hong Kong enjoyed a prosperity as never before, because as the Japanese army invaded China, the people with money and talent and skill all came to Hong Kong. They brought with them their fortunes, their skill, and their talents. They opened factories in Hong Kong, and Hong Kong became a manufacturing and industrial center. Textiles were produced, were exported from Hong Kong, made in Hong Kong, embroideries, and all other handicraft or exportable material, electronics, and all were made in Hong Kong. The Hong Kong prospered from their skills. People from Shanghai came, from Shantou, Amoy, Fuzhou, and we really had a period of prosperity until almost up to the very verge of the war. The people had a mentality that it can't happen here. In 1938, the Japanese landed at Murs Bay and marched on Canton. In July 1940, the British government evacuated all military wives and children out of Hong Kong. They were not allowed to go to Manila or Singapore, but had to go, either voluntary or otherwise, to Australia or UK. And sometimes, in retrospect, I wonder if there in their wisdom had figured on the possibility of the fall of Singapore as well as Manila. However, after July, August, it followed with civilians, all British staff in British companies and otherwise, were all ordered to leave Hong Kong. As a result, many joined the volunteer VAD, the Voluntary Aid Detachment. That is a nursing branch of the Hong Kong Volunteer Defense Force. Others joined the ARP, Air Raid Warriors. Others joined the Central Services or the Police Reserves. But some way or other, these are the people who dodged from going out of Hong Kong to UK or Australia. They didn't want to drag away their families, or they didn't trust their husbands with the Susan Wongs of Hong Kong.
So, could I ask you now, Arthur, about joining the volunteers? I think you said, what date was that when you joined? 1938? Yes. Could you tell me about the volunteers? Had it just started then, or had it been going some time?
The Hong Kong volunteers started way back when the Crimea War, as way back as that. And there is a book written by a friend of mine, whom I helped with. Invited me to give her a foreword to her book. It's Hong Kong Invasion. It was the people of Hong Kong at that time were fearful of an invasion from Kowloon, and it was an imaginative story of how Hong Kong was invaded by forces at that time. The British in that war withdrew the army and the forces from the Far East as much as possible, and this drainage had caused a necessity for or need for the local people to join the militia, and the Hong Kong Volunteers was formed. The call was made, and 69 men answered the call. Strange enough, the descendant of one of the original people is still alive, was in the Volunteers, fought in the war, fought in the prison camp with me, and is now living in Australia. His name is Philip Ivanovich. He's not Russian, he's Portuguese.
So tell me about your joining. Why did you join the Volunteers?
It was a popular thing for young people to do at that time. When you join the Volunteers, you have a rifle which you could take home. And we are a member of a rifle club. We were all practicing for the Brisbane shooting competition. And we enjoyed on Sundays to go out rifle shooting at the rifle range. And by the way, we still have use of the rifle range which the Volunteers had. And today, the Royal Hong Kong Regiment Association, the Volunteers, with a clubhouse in Jockey Club, Happy Valley, we still maintain the use of that range, and we call it the Rifle Club, and members of which I'm a member too, and I'm a director of the association, we were allowed to join that club and go shooting too, if you like. So there hasn't been much change with the Volunteers are concerned, really.
So could you tell me about the sort of makeup of the Volunteers? Were they all different social classes and national groups?
Yes. The Hong Kong Volunteers, at the time we went to war, number one company British, number two company Scottish, number three company Eurasians, four company, I think, the Chinese company, number five and number six companies were Portuguese companies. Number seven was a Chinese company. Number one, I think, was a machine gun and gun carrier. Number two were gun carriers and machine guns. And the three were the machine gun company. They're mostly machine gun company. Number four was infantry, rifles. Number five and six, which are number five and number six, were also machine guns. Number five were the machine guns. We used Vickers Mark IV machine guns. And number six company used the Lewis gun. And they were known as the AALA, Anti-Aircraft Light Automatics.
It's interesting you saying about the Portuguese, yeah. You know, because Portugal wasn't in the war, was it?
No, we're neutral. The Portuguese in Hong Kong had dual nationality. Most of them were British subjects. We were all British subjects. But we all had dual nationality. And we all decided to join the Volunteers.
What sort of training did you have? Apart from your rifle, you were saying about machine guns.
On weekends, we went up to headquarters and we learned how to use the gun, to dismantle the gun, to fix the gun, to keep the gun firing under any conditions. And until we were quite skillful in the use of the guns. And that proved very, very useful to us, because in the dark, you can still manage the gun without being able to see it. And that's how we were trained. We were very well trained how to use those guns. And especially when we were in camp, from the 1st to the 8th of, supposed to be in camp from the 1st to the 8th of December 1941. Fortunately, the camp broke up on the 7th. before it was due to end, by obvious reasons.
Yes, I will ask you a lot about that later.
Yes,
but just at this early time, because it's so interesting what you're saying, Arthur. It's so interesting what you're telling me about the volunteers.
Yes.
And who were your commanding officers? Would they have been British?
Was Captain Chris, my company was Captain Chris Dalmada, and my platoon commander was Lieutenant Billy Alvis. They're both deceased.
So apart from your weapons, what other training did you have? Did you have route marches and drill?
Oh yes, we had all kinds of training. We had route marches, and I must tell you, when we went on a route march, we began off quite nicely, everybody in step. But after a mile or two, then people begin to lose the steps. They crawl along like a centipede. And so they sent a piper along from the Scottish group. And the moment that pipe went, we were all swung into step. It's a wonderful to march to. We went to military camps. We were under canvas in Fanling. Fanling is a place, is near Lowell, near the frontier with China. And we were in camp not far from where the Japanese army were preparing to attack Hong Kong at that time. And unbeknown to us. And we were quite happy. The people of Hong Kong were all bent on making the dollar. Everybody was happy. Until the last moment, we were having big dance balls for the Bomber Fund to contribute money to build bombers for Britain's war efforts. There were two shipyards in Hong Kong, the Kowloon Docks, which I had mentioned previously, and Kowloon Docks are launching this large 10,000 ton cargo vessels, what the Empire series. One was called the Empire Moonbeam, and the other one that was built in Taikoo Docks, I think, was called Empire Sunrise or something like that. They're all Empire ships, and they were launching these ships for the British war effort. Sir Robert Hotung, the great gentleman of Hong Kong, a much honored and revered person, was celebrating his Diamond Jubilee, I believe, and that all the elite was preparing to go to this great ball.
Given the fact that war had broken out, you know, in England, that, you know, Europe was
yes.
at war,
yes.
and that the Japanese had advanced so
yes.
far in Indochina,
yes.
what were the, when you think back, what were the war preparations in Hong Kong? First of all, the army. What sort of army defences was there? I know we've got the volunteers.
Yes. Well, at first, Churchill had decided, as he said in Parliament, we will not fritter away our resources. In other words, we will not send any reinforcements to Hong Kong. But this had a very deleterious effect on the morale of the Chinese army in China, fighting the Japanese. And I think for political considerations, arrangements were made to send reinforcements to Hong Kong. But reinforcements came in the shape of manpower, not in firepower, really. Two Canadian regiments came to Hong Kong, 2,000 Canadians, about. And they came, the Winnipeg Grenadiers and the Royal Rifles of Canada. They arrived in Hong Kong on the vessel, the Prince Rupert, on the 19th of November 1944. 1941. So it wasn't very long in Hong Kong before they had their baptismal fire.
Do you remember their arrival?
Yes, I do. There were great fanfare of their arrival, and they were stationed at Sham Shui Po Barracks, which was evacuated by the Middlesex Regiment for them. Sham Shui Po prison barracks eventually became our prison camp, and I will comment on that later.
So was that... Did the arrival of the Canadians raise morale? Was it good to have these?
Yes, they did. They made us more certain that it couldn't happen here. Unfortunately for the Canadians, they arrived without their most transport equipment, which was sent to Manila. And of course, that was a factor in the war, really, in Hong Kong, eventually. We got to, the Canadians and us got, and the volunteers got together very well in, during the war and after the war, and during, particularly during the period of imprisonment.
Yes, I would it would be interesting to hear about that later, Arthur.
Yeah.
Having explained the sort of army situation, what was the naval presence that you recall in Hong Kong? Was there much in the way of a naval presence?
Hong Kong was extremely weak in the way of navy. The naval force, when, as a schoolboy, I remember we had the China Squadron, and we had an aircraft carrier, HMS Eagle, where the submarine mothership, HMS Medway, with a flock of a group of submarines. We had the county class cruisers, HMS Cumberland, HMS Kent, HMS Berwick, and we had the fleet of destroyers. It was a complete fighting force. But when, at the time of the outbreak of the war, the fleet was reduced to 3 old-age destroyers. HMS Thracian, HMS Scout, and another, I can't remember the name right now. The Scout and the other destroyer, the younger ones, we dashed off to Singapore about a day or so before the war. The British intelligence knew that things were happening. The intelligence was good. The Thracian, the old ship, was left behind to lay mines around Hong Kong and for any other purpose. And we had 2 small river boats. The insect class, the name alone will tell you the size of these ships. They carry about 4 pounders. HMS.
Not to worry, if you don't worry so much. It's just the sort of size of the force which is so interesting.
One of the was destroyed by bombing in the shipyard, in the docks. But the other, HMS Sikala, under the command of Captain Boldero, an experienced naval, Royal Navy man with one arm. And he fought a beautiful war. He was actually a floating anti-aircraft battery. And he kept the aircraft out until they finally bombed him out, and he was sunk off Hong Kong. Near Hong Kong, around Repulse Bay, and with very light casualties, very, very light. He was a very brave man. The Thracian had played an important part when the Japanese had occupied the whole of Kowloon, and there in daylight moved nighttime, which extended into the daylight, early daylight, in removing the troops from Kowloon to Hong Kong, from being captured in Kowloon. She ran the gauntlet before the jet could bring in their artillery or focus properly. He can escape them. And of course, the aircraft went for this vessel, and they eventually, and they decided that it would be lost. She was damaged, and they took off all her armaments and